Hi, this is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy. Be sure to check us out on our blog and YouTube and our great sponsors, Your Dolce Vita, Italy Rooting, and Abitivo Casa. And today I have a guest from Australia, first Australian, Sarah Nielsen. So welcome, Sarah. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
So we have a big time difference. It's 5:30 a.m. here. And what time is it there?
9:30 p.m.
Oh, my goodness. That's even more, that's even more than I thought. And I guess we must be, I don't know, how many miles away? 12,000, 10,000?
Oh, my gosh, like a lot.
You know, I've been to the Orient. I've been to Hong Kong and I've been to Manila, and but I've never made it to Australia. I used to work for Chase. So maybe someday we'll get there. When and why did you start researching your family?
I think I've always been interested. My grandfather, being a, he immigrated to Australia when he was in his early 20s. He was always really interested for us to be interested in the story. And surprisingly, whilst there's so many, people who have Italian heritage in Australia and in Victoria, where I am, it was still very rare. And it was something that was special to our family, particularly that my father's side is so Australian and then my mother's side was so Italian. I think I'd always had a really, I looked the most Italian in the family. So I think that was always something that drew me, to the interest of it. I probably had a lot to do with my great uncle and auntie as well. Out of all of the grandchildren, I probably had the most to do with them growing up. So I suppose you could say it was influence as well that I guess sparks interest.
You know, and that's funny that you mentioned that you look the most Italian, because you do look Italian. You look Italian. Although Italians, you know, we don't look like anybody, and we look like everybody, if you know what I mean.
That's right. Yes.
So you said your dad came in when he, or your grandfather came when he was in his 20s. So what year was that?
He arrived in, he flew into Darwin. He actually flew here in 1948.
Oh, so just after the war. So now we're there. I mean, you know, Americans think a lot different, I'm sure, than Australians do about the immigration, because our big immigration was in the early 1900s, and then they stopped for a while. So now, was there a big influx of Italians to Australia after the war?
There was, but my grandfather, he was quite early. His father had tried to get them here earlier, but as I've recently found out, first of all, they were not. The application was in 1946, and Australia were not going to allow them to come until the peace treaty was signed with the king. So. There was my, interestingly, whilst it was my grandfather and his younger brother that came out first, aside from my great grandfather, it was his mother and his youngest brother that were approved first, because she was a female, she was coming to be with her husband. That was harmless. And his youngest brother was only 13 at the time of application. So again, harmless. Whereas the three brothers, there was four boys. And so the three brothers in between, they were adults, being the age they were, I suppose the Australians probably looked at them as a risk, given that they'd just so recently been at war with their country. And so they were held back. It was supposed to be, you know, the three brothers came together and the youngest would come with my great grandmother. But, and this story, I have no proof of this story. This is hand me down. The shipping fare was booked for the three brothers, which fits to the documents I have got from Australia. But they missed the train from Malacucca in Calabria to get to Messina to then get on the boat. And so my great-grandfather somehow from Australia basically traded in the shipping fare for an airline ticket, but only for two of them. So my grandfather and his younger brother came and his older brother stayed. And then that's when they came out in 48.
Oh, that's interesting. And I was going to say that would have been some boat ride.
Oh my gosh. Boat ride or plane ride. Either of them don't.
Yeah, I guess back then. Yeah. You know, the ship to America used to take, you know, a good trip, you know, maybe would take 10 days, but, you know, sometimes they would take as long as 3 weeks.
So it was a month here. It took them a month to get here.
Wow. That's a long time. That's quite a long time. And so now that when they came, did they come in? You mentioned that there's a large community there, but was it a large community back then or was it just starting to grow?
So there was Italians that had already come here, and it's funny you say that because I wanted part of my research is always I've always been fascinated with what brought you here, like what brought them here, and what did they come to? It would have been really frightening, particularly Australia, like you know, to sail into Ellis Island would be completely different to sail into Hobson's Bay here in Victoria. You know, there was very little here even. My great-grandfather, and he puts it on his naturalization documents that he didn't like to have much to do with the Italian community, which was interesting. And the family, it's funny that I saw that written in documents. And yet my great aunt, who's still with us and remembers him, said, you know, he never, ever wanted to mix with the people. He never wanted to shop in the Italian shops. And that was, you know, that was something they knew, that was a comfort of home. And he never wanted to do that. He wanted to be, I guess, British from the moment he came here or chose to come here. So when my grandfather and his brother arrived, they actually flew into Darwin. They couldn't speak a word of English. And my grandfather, his photo is in the newspaper as that all they could say, they were going to a place in Victoria called Port Campbell, which was where my great-grandfather's farm was. But, you know, the people wherever they were in the, you know, airport, I suppose, couldn't understand their accents. And so they thought they were saying Port Kembla, which is not in Victoria. And so they're saying, oh, they need to get to Port Kembla. And he's, you know, there's a photo of my grandfather like looking through this book. And there was a lady that traveled with them that they stayed in contact with. She was from home as well. But they finally got there in the end. But even then, like to fly in, you know, I mean, even I know now where we are, we're at the very southern tip of the country other than Tasmania. They flew into the very top. I can only imagine back then it was still, you know, a whole other journey again to get from where they were to where they needed to be.
Yeah. And it was probably a journey to get from Calabria to any place too. Cause I mean, I know when I was there just last year in the car, it was quite a journey going up some of these mountains and places like that. So now why did they choose Australia and not England or America or South America?
It's interesting because my great grandfather's brother went to Argentina. He went to Buenos Aires. So I always wondered why here, you know, and there was a few families from the town that had come to Australia who were already here. And I'd done a bit of research on how close, you know, finding things like how close were they to our family? Where were they? What were their families doing, you know, that might have been an influence? So all I can suggest there was a family that were quite close to them that is now, you know, amazingly, it's sort of in my childhood been a household name. And to then date it back to our immigration here, I believe it is that sort of people from the town had said, no, we can get more for what we're looking for. They all seem to settle here and go to property. So You know, we don't really have anyone in the family that sort of settled and just sort of were city dwellers. There wasn't a lot of that. My grandmother's family, when they came out, you know, in the mid to late 50s, that was different. They lived in the city and stayed there. When my great grandfather, the first time he came out was 1926. It was for farming. That was their whole aim.
And so back then, was Australia very open? Because in that, you know, right after, I think it was 1922, 23, something around there, the United States put a very strict quota on Italians coming in. So was now Australia, because Australia was obviously 50, 75, maybe even 100 years behind us in the immigration. Was it open back then more for Italians, especially farmers, to come in?
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com.
It was, I guess, the government were open to it because we were so, the country was so infant still. And some people were quite welcoming. Even where he went, it was a very, very small community. It's still a small community today. So it's interesting that he ended up there. I've got a letter written to a, he's a politician of some sort, and it was during the war, and it was a neighbour that had written it, sort of dobbing him in, saying, you know, there's this Italian who's got this land. This should be a soldier that has this land. An Australian should have it. And he, you know, he's there by himself, and he doesn't even give anyone a job. And it was really laying into him, really. And it's interesting that I've got in touch with someone who's down there who remembers this man, and he said, oh, his family will be mortified that he wrote this letter. And I said, but that was how they, I understand it. I understand why he wrote that. They thought they were taking their jobs and taking their land. Whereas then written in his naturalization, a local policeman had given, you know, sort of a reference for him. And he said, look, not all the farmers like him in the area. And he said, and from what I can tell, it's because he runs his farm far better than they do. He works harder than they do. And that's not a point to gloat on. It's a point of fact. They did. They came here for a purpose. They came here to work really hard. And everything they worked hard for, they wanted to make the most of. So I think whilst the country was open to him being here, he got a really great plot of land. He put in a lease for it. He basically had to promise what he was going to do to the land. On that initial application of Crown land, he had to clear it. He had to fence it. I think they gave him an allowance for a wire fencing. He had to build his own hut. And on his application, this was in the mid-30s, so 1934 he filled this out. So he'd just come back from a trip in Italy where he, you know, his fourth son had been born. He came back and he completely falsified the application. He said he was single. He lied about his age. He said he had no children. And it was interesting because when I found this document, you know, particularly for like my mother, that was a really difficult thing to read, to sort of say, why did he lie? Why did he deny that he had? Was he running away from them? And I spoke to a wonderful lady who runs the Italian Museum here in Melbourne, and she said they did what they had to survive. You have to remember, they'd come all this way. That's what they were going to do. They were going to do whatever it took. They didn't care what they were filling out. And I suppose I understand that, you know, it was just a piece of paper. He didn't care. He just wanted that land. And his neighbour, so he was Lebanese, his neighbour, and his grandson I've spoken to, And he said, we always wanted to know how he got that land. We always wanted to know how he won that. And I said, well, he lied. That's how he got it. I said, your grandfather was honest. Mine wasn't.
And so for the Americans listening, what exactly is Crown land? Because
so Crown land, well, it's land that was, it was owned by the British. I mean, they founded the country, so they considered themselves the owners of it. And so what they would do is they would sell off plots, and, you know, what are you going to do with it? Hey, and it's amazing. They had to write these scripts on why they would be great for it and what experience do they have. I suppose it was like a job interview. And, you know, he said, oh, my, you know, my mother ran a vineyard in Italy and I ran that. And I, you know, and it's funny. It's like, yes, your mother inherited, along with five or six other families, like most Italians, you know, a small vineyard that probably supplied your own wine and maybe to sell a tiny bit within the village and maybe some olive trees on it as well. I wouldn't say that was a 450-acre farm, dairy farm, like you were signing on to. But it was, you know, even his neighbour, the Lebanese neighbour, he said, oh, my grandfather had written on there that I'm an expert dairy farmer. He said he might have milked a goat as a child, perhaps. And he said that was the closest he came. But that was, yeah, that was what they had to prove to the Crown. So, you know, government representatives that, you know, that they should be. So they were leased the land for an amount of time and they just kept paying it until it was usually after about 10 years, sometimes more. They had to prove, I think it was 6 years he had to prove what he'd done. So they had 6 years to really get it happening. And then by 6 years, they would be told, okay, yes, you can continue. And I think it wasn't until the mid-50s that he actually then they signed it over and said, yep, you now own this. It's now yours. So it was, you know, it was a good 20 years of just paying the government for this farm.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we had programs like that here in, I don't know, the 1820s, 1830s, you know, I guess it was, you know, similar. They were trying to go west and build out and you could
yes.
get, you lease land and then eventually own it. Or in some cases, I think they may have even given it away just to get people out there. But then,
yes,
you know, you had to deal with the Indians and everything. So
absolutely. Yes.
It wasn't a simple life. So now, you know, have you, what interesting things have you found out about the family, you know, back in Italy, if anything?
So one of the most interesting things I found out particularly about him, I've always been fascinated with my great-grandfather because we share a birthday. So for me growing up, that was a really big deal. I, you know, it was always said to me, oh my gosh, you share the birthday with your great-grandfather. You're so lucky. It's, you know, one of the things I found out about him was that I was lucky enough to inherit a lot of documents from my great uncle when he passed away. So in those documents were things that it is unimaginable that they bought these handwritten documents all the way from Italy to Australia, stored them. I mean, they're in pretty good condition for what they are and what they've traveled. Some of them are, you know, sort of deeds to land, agreements or arrangements over land. A lot of it has had to take a lot of translation, which is difficult being Calabrian and from Malacca. It's a lot of it's written in dialect. So when you do try and translate it, it's all over the place. So you've sort of got to start to put together what you're reading and I guess it teaches you to recognize different words and what they partner with. So we found out that obviously my great-grandfather had to do national service when he was 18, like most men in Italy. And I've got a photo that his brother had put together. So when his brother Pasquale moved to Buenos Aires, he took a photo of himself and a photo of my great-grandfather and he merged them together. And, you know, it says, you know, the two brothers, Pasquale in Buenos Aires and Antonio. Now, Antonio at this stage was still in Italy. So that's obviously where he's sent it to. And Antonio's in a military uniform. And I always just looked at this photo and thought, oh, it's just, you know, he's in his national service. But then the more I looked into the dates, and I thought, no, he's, you know, he's 24 in this photo. He's actually married. And then I've got another certificate that is the insurance for someone, for a soldier. So I went to a woman who she's fluent Italian. She can sort of decipher all this stuff. She's quite an expert. And she said, oh, no, she said, yeah, your great-grandfather was obviously in the military. That's his insurance. And I said, well, this is a photo of him. You know, where can I find any more information? What does the uniform look like? And she said, oh, that's definitely a black shirt. And that, I mean, for our family, that was something. I still remember my mother's message to me. No, she just said no. And I said, no, very yes. And she said, no. I said, but that's what they were brought up with. That's what they believed to be correct. That was their, you know, that was what their world looked like in their country. And I've always sort of wondered, was it something to do with that he wanted to leave there? Was it that, you know, I said to my great aunt, we were always told that they were peasants, you know, the family were really poor. And my great aunt, it's funny how as they get older, they tell you how it really was. She said, they weren't poor. She said, they weren't poor at all. They owned land. They were essentially what we would call here middle class. And she said, no, it was a choice. So that's always intrigued me and interested me that, you know, he made this choice to leave. His father had passed away. I believe his mother had died somewhere around the early 20s. So perhaps he had no one other than his wife. You know, but still at the same time, I guess I'm removed enough in generations and I can, you know, I love research, so I can look at it a little bit more objectively, but that he left a wife and children, yes, to go and build this life. I mean, before his children came out, he was here 21 or 22 years, which is a really long time, a really long time to be you've missed everything with the upbringing of your children. You missed everything. So these boys arrived in Australia and he had no idea how to be a father and they really had no idea how to be sons. So it was certainly an interesting adjustment for them as well.
I bet. Yeah. That's quite a story. And that's really something that they preserved all those documents.
Oh, yes. Yes. There's quite a lot, even down to things like, you know, I've got it comes up as translation, like a tax, but I assume it's like paying your rates. So he was still paying for this land all these years between him and his sister. They were paying the rates on these properties. I've got a lot of letters. Deciphering them is really challenging. So it's trying to read the handwriting and then trying to translate the handwriting and going through. He was constantly asking people and getting people in Malakukar to try and check up on you know, what I can only assume is the vineyard and the grove and the property. And he's writing to these people and it's, can you check on this? And they're writing, it's the letters back saying, you know, we've tried to look for what you're asking for and we can't search anymore. And I feel like he was constantly sort of keeping a tab on what was going on there. But I haven't at this stage got to the sort of the crux of why.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess maybe he just wanted to keep his hand and things.
Yeah.
You know, I learned from one of my cousins, my fourth cousin that her uncle apparently had a lot of stuff, but when he died, it all disappeared.
Yes.
Which, you know, which kills me, because yes. They were all my grandmother's family. They were all property owners, and you know, on some of their birth and death certificates, it just says some say property owner, some just say rich person. So,
oh wow,
you know, they were like, she was from two noble families, so they were like extremely well off. But now, have you been able to get back yet?
No.
Yeah, I was afraid of that. Well, you have plenty of time to go back.
Well, my mum and my dad have been, and my sister has been, which is amazing. And my aunt was there recently, which she said, you know, the family home, it was just fascinating the way it, and they did. They honestly just packed it up, locked it up and left.
Wow.
And my uncle, my great uncle, he went back in 1968 and he bought some things back with him. But even then, that was more because my grandmother, my great grandmother was the one who was left there. It was more items of hers. And I feel like a lot of the photos that I've got, perhaps he bought back with him on that trip. You know, these are some incredibly old photos. And it's fun going through. There's so many, and to go through them and make contact with people and say, do you recognize it? Does anyone recognize this person? Does anyone know who this might be? Some of them I'm lucky enough, they've written a name or a last name on the back. But yeah, to try and retrace where they were. My grandfather never wanted to go back. He had no interest whatsoever. Once he came to Australia, he used to have a saying to us kids, obviously, who were born here, and he used to say, I'm more Australian than any of you. And I remember in my teenage years, I said, you're not, because you were born there and I'm born here. And my father's Australian. He said, I don't care. He said, I'm more Australian than you. I said, tell me how you figure that. And he said, because I chose this country, you didn't. And it makes sense. You know, the first thing, they couldn't wait to buy Holdens when they got out here, which I don't know how many Americans know. That's a very quintessential Australian thing. And yet my great-grandfather, one of his pride and joys, I think it was about a year before he died, who knows how long it was on the wait list, but he imported a Chevy Impala to Australia. And this guy who's still alive, and he said to me, he goes, oh, he said, I was about 14 when your great-grandfather bought that thing back. And he said, you know, farming roads were very quiet, and he said, we could hear this rumble of this engine. He said, my brother and I, and we were like, what is that noise? And he said, all of a sudden, he said, this thing is slowing down and getting louder near the top of our driveway. And we've looked down our driveway, and this massive, massive V8's just coming down our driveway. And he said, and there was your great-grandfather with the biggest grin on his face behind the steering wheel. And that was his, but he'd done like, and I don't know if it's the same for you, the businesses there, the farmers all had their name on the door of their trucks. And he'd put the name on the door of his Chevy Impala. So he'd sort of just still gone with the farmer's rule. But yeah, it was that was something that I found so interesting still, that he spoilt himself a little bit with something, well, a lot actually, but with something, so, you know, that he just loved. It's what he wanted.
That's so funny. And, you know, when you go back to some of these small towns, you know, you mentioned that they just left everything there. When we were in,
yes,
in Fasado and Montebello, there were whole streets of, you know, flats or, you know, apartments, whatever, where people just left. I mean, there's still furniture in there. There's still everything, yes, in there. And this, you know, they told me that they're owned by people maybe in Germany or France or even America or other places. And it's amazing just to see that. It's amazing and sad in a way. And we were able to go into my third great grandparents' palazzo in Fasado, and it was really bittersweet because the current owner, you know, it's he owns the property and he's built a regular house, and there's some other houses around it, but he let us in, so you could still see what it once was.
Yes.
But he has no desire to fix it. And the town wanted to buy it and refurbish it, and he doesn't want to sell it. So it's kind of sad, you know, when you see that.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one thing. everyone who's been to Melukukah has said, we're so upset that we can't just go inside the house and see what's there. And I mean, I do believe that my great uncle would have taken anything that was of value in terms of that he knew would mean something to us one day. But even the smallest things can be valuable. It's I know that one of the brothers went back in the 70s trying to look. I think they all four brothers grieved the loss of their mother and father differently. I think they grieved it probably separately as well. And so they were all still trying to sort of find themselves. He went back and people tried to help him. I don't really know what he was looking for. You know, probably just some sort of comfort in it all. But interestingly, everyone who's been, even my sister, who is so not ever been really super moved by this sort of stuff, she said, just being there, it's amazing how you feel like you're somewhere of comfort and like you're meant to be there. You know, it's a very interesting feeling.
Yeah, no, there's no question about that. And, you know, I've said this before. I know people who go to Italy and they, you know, I ask them, are you going to go back to the hometown? And they say, no, I don't know anybody. I don't, you know, there's nobody there. There's nobody left. And I said, yeah, but you don't know until you get there and you don't know the yes. feeling. And that's, you know, that's the homecoming to me anyway, at least that's the way I felt. And, there's so many amazing stories where people are just walking down the street and they'll say, you look like somebody, you know, or you'll remember a photograph and you find out that this person's a relative, you know?
Yes. Yes. So
it's really, really something. So I have to ask you now about your dad's family. When did they get to Australia?
The Australian side or my grandmother's family? The Australian side.
The Australian side, yeah.
They, so my dad's father's side, they were early 1800s. And my grandmother's side, they were actually only just sort of late 1880s, all of them. So a little bit later. Some from Scotland. Some little bit of Irish in there, but mostly Scottish or from Cornwall, around that area. So it was such a difference in culture, in terms of everything. Even my mum, the story she tells about, you know, first, as she uses the term, I don't know if this is a term there, it's one that's very daggy here, but going round with my dad, that's what she would call it. And when they were first together, my dad's family was still sort of extremely Scottish influenced, and they thought, you're dating an Italian girl, what? You know, and she's Catholic as well, which was just an extra,
right.
yeah, an additional. And my mum said she still remembers my dad's grandfather ringing every night, and he'd ring and he'd say, what are you feeding him tonight, dear? And she'd say, I'm making pasta tonight. And she said, he just got me every time I was saying pasta. She said, I didn't cook pasta every night, but it was just, and he'd say, what are you cooking him pasta for? You need to give him a steak. That's what he needs. And she said, they must have just thought that's all we ate, just pasta. But it was interesting, the crossing cultures, and even just, I still remember as a child, them learning about that culture. I mean, our family has all embraced it a lot. You know, my generation, my mum's generation, my uncle married another sort of Italian. I'm second generation Italian. So that was interesting again. They were from a different part of Italy. But all three girls, so my mum and her two sisters, all married Australian men.
Yeah, you know, in my mom's family, everybody married an Italian except for my mom's youngest brother, and she was actually Scottish, believe it or not. And my father's family, his older brother married a woman who was actually I don't know what her nationality was, but she was Protestant. So I'm sure when he got married in the 1920s, that must have been a huge deal for my grandparents to deal with. But yeah, that's so interesting. So now was it your dad's father's family that came in the early 1800s? Do you know why they came?
I'm not sure. We've got a family book, but interestingly, they came from a part of Scotland that I don't imagine I don't believe they were poor. I think they were okay. It was something people were doing. It was this promise of a better life out here. Again, they were all landowners. They came out here and got significantly large pieces of land. Their children ended up sort of living in a city and that sort of thing. But their heritage was interesting from Scotland. There was no sort of evident prompt that you could say brought them out here, but a lot of them came at once. And doing their family history is fascinating because there's so many of them, and then throw into a mix that some of them changed the last name slightly. So then you've got this whole other arm of the family that you sort of didn't even know was there. yes, there was no major prompt. Some of the English more so, it was probably poverty. And that's what I've noticed. That's what I've noticed from them. And when they did come out here, they worked really hard. They did well for themselves. But mainly the Scottish, it's quite interesting that they, whether there was sort of almost, I know they were all part of clans and following that on, we all watch Outlander and think it's amazing and think, is it really a thing? But I guess it does tell a historical tale where were some of those things an influence into their decision to come here when the opportunity arose.
Yeah, and that's a great show. We really enjoyed that show. we lived in England for 2 years in the 90s. So we got to go, we went to Aberdeen. They had these like corporate games or something like that, but we had just taken a drive through the countryside, and it was really amazing because, every few miles you'd see this like little miniature type of castle thing. Like,
yes,
it was basically just three rooms, but three rooms on top of each other. But you could see it was like sort of like a fortress. But as we were driving along, I looked out to the left and I saw what looked like this, like Cinderella type castle. And yeah. I said to my wife, I said, we have to see what that is on the way back. So on the way back, we saw the sign and it was Balmoral.
And, oh, wow.
And we, you could, you know, that was actually open. They had, the queen wasn't there. So they you were allowed to go into like two rooms or something like that. If she's there, you can't go in. But it was really amazing because it was this long road with just these giant pine trees, and you could smell the pine trees. And then when you got there, you could actually walk down to, and I'm sure everybody's seen the photo of either the queen or the prince by that stream, And so you could actually go stand by that stream where they stand.
Wow.
It was really, really an amazing place to see, because it really truly looks like Cinderella's castle.
Yes.
It was really special, and I have a photo. I'll have to put it up there when I talk about
oh it. Wow. It's that side of it, it intrigues me why they came here, things that drew them here, because one of them, so on my grandmother's side, it turns out after much research they were actually an adopted relation, but they were an influential part regardless, because they who brought up my great grandmother, and he actually, her grandfather came out here because he was a evangelist. He had fallen on hard times living in England. He lost his wife, and he ended up, he listened to Charles Spurgeon, and actually became quite heavily involved with that revival movement. And they said, look, we're, you know, he lost his voice due to the trauma. There's an article written about it, and he lost his voice due to the trauma. And they said, do you know what? We're sending people to this place called Australia, and we think you should go there. The climate will work better for your voice box. And he said, okay, I'll try it. So he took his four children out there and arrived here in the late 1800s. And I mean, came to Victoria, came to Paran, which was, I mean, not very nice back then, but that was where all the evangelists were. They wanted to get, you know, to the people that really needed help. And that's how they ended up coming out here. And I just find that, you know, they were really well-educated children, just because their father sort of, I guess, lapsed into his own sort of crisis, they ended up in a place that I can't imagine coming from somewhere like England to what Australia would have been then. It would have been just such a stark contrast to what they knew.
Yeah, I know. And you know, when you think about that, you know, it's a huge place, like, you know, the United States is. And like I said, you know, the people who pushed west in the, you know, late 1700s, early 1800s, it's hard to imagine what it must have been like. You just really can't imagine.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, it's fate. We're where we are because of fate when you think about it, right?
That's right. And it's interesting. Recently I connected with someone through Ancestry, through my DNA. There was a few matches, and I must say it's really difficult when you've done your DNA and you've got one side that is Italian. It is because our records are not what everyone else's are. I mean, I'm so fortunate. I've got a lot of documents that have probably helped me along the way. I've got a lot of stories. You know, my grandfather liked to tell stories. I've got photos. It's so much more than a lot of people have. But I connected with a woman who is also in America, and I said to her, you know, this name features in your trees. I'm just wondering what the connection is. And this was through my grandfather's mother's side of the family. And she knew very little. We just had the same great-great-grandfather name. The mother's name was similar enough that, you know, we could see it was the same person, but just lost in translation. Her name's Margarita, but someone had written Margareta, you know, neither here nor there. But we pieced it together, and her great-grandfather is the older brother of my great-grandmother, and she didn't even know that she existed. And she said we had no idea that she'd gone to Australia. And I said, well, your great-grandfather was so much older, and he went to America, you know, so much earlier. She was still a girl, and off he went. And it's funny then all these little names. And she said, well, what about this person? He went back to see this person. And I said, yes, that's, you know, and I guess we pieced it all together. There's still a few little mysteries we need to sort out, but it's amazing to connect with people that you would never have even known were part of your family at all. And I deal with people that are, you know, 10 times removed, and I still consider them a cousin. She's so closely related. She is so closely related. And that side of it, I just find so fascinating. I've still got sort of things here that I said, you know, this is your great-great uncle that wrote this letter as well. So it's to be enjoyed by you as much as it is by us. Which that side of it, I just find so fascinating. Just one, I could never imagine. I mean, my sister and I live, we're not overly close, but we live 10 minutes apart. We will at least speak once a week, and she's looking at moving at the moment half an hour from me, and that's been such a big discussion point. She's going to live half an hour away from me. I think they lived literally on opposite sides of the world, and in a time where you couldn't just write them an email. You could barely even write them a letter guaranteeing it would get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, bugs me. The Italians, you know, the Italians in Italy don't do DNA, very, very few. So it's very hard to piece that together. But, I knew who my grandmother's father's family was. And I had a couple of documents going back. I was lucky enough to be able to find my great grandfather and his father. And but my cousin over there, she, because the family was originally from Spain, she thought she was going to find people either in Spain or in South America. She never had any idea that there was anybody in America. And in fact, only my grandmother and her aunt came to America. So she was quite surprised. And when we found each other, I mean, she just had so much information, and she's in Italy, obviously. So it's a lot easier to find out, but she's the one who was able to find all of these homes, of which at last count, I think there were six or seven that my third great grandfather or grandparents had because of their stature. But, you know, I tell people too, the same thing. You go out on Facebook, go to the town, see if there's something in the town, or go to the commune, or just, you know, go to my blog, because a lot of people are finding each other there. But I never thought it was going to get to where it is. There's like there's over 11,000 people in that group now. People are finding each other there.
Yes.
So that's just so, you know, that makes me feel good. That was the whole reason in doing this in the first place, to help people find each other.
It's such a lovely, and it's when I got all of these photos, and we're part of a group that it's a group on Facebook in Malakukar, you know, and I started sharing all these photos one night. I just said, I'll just put these up and just see if anyone knows. And the joy that it brought to some of these older people looking that knew all these faces. And interestingly enough, in my great-grandfather's things, he has a little book it's written in Italian. It's a tiny little book. I imagine it's something he bought out here. It's about, my auntie has said to me, she said, it's written about the king, like it's the Italian king is in there. And I said, okay, so it's maybe a book that he bought out at that time, or were they gifted it? But in the front and in the back, it's printed, it's someone else's name. And I said, well, did he steal this book from someone? Because it's not his. And she said, oh, no, we know that family. I don't know. Maybe they lent it to him. And this last name is, there's a little boy that my son goes to school with who's got this last name. And his mum, it's his father that's Italian, but his mum, she's Scottish, born in New Zealand, now in Australia, but her family's Scottish. And she loves family history. And I said to her, how funny is this that I've got this book that was my great-grandfather's and it's got Lupino written in it? And she said, that is amazing. You've got to, let's find out who it is, you know. And so I asked my great aunt and she said, oh, yeah, we knew the Lupinos. They're, you know, there's a lot of them around. There's a lot. And we've managed, like we did so much work on this, and we found that at one stage my great-grandfather stayed with a family member that is Lupino, that we believe is that the book belonged to. We think it was lent to him then. But we found out that this little boy's grandfather, who's still alive, lives in the next suburb to me, he was friends with my grandparents when they came to Australia, and they all knew each other. Because I said to her, I said, where in Italy is your husband's family from? She said, oh, it's a very little town. You probably don't know. It's in Calabria. It's a tiny town. And I said, oh, no, you know, so is my family. She said, oh, it's called Malakukar. And I said, you are got to be joking. And it's her mother-in-law now. She said, when I show her the photos that you've got and she's looking at all these faces and Malakukar, it's just, it brings them back to life to, I know that person and this is who this is and that's where that's taken. And she said that the joy that it brings them and puts another spark, you know, into them. And even, you know, my great aunt and my grandmother who'll say, oh yeah, that person, they lived here. And it's like they're talking about something last week, which I love that. I love that it, you know, if it can add a little bit of something to everyone, it's, you know, it's your job done. as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, we have a great person over here that I interviewed, Kate Kelly, and she's called the photo angel. She goes to antique places and secondhand places, and she looks for photos or documents with people's names on it that have names on it, and then she finds the family and sends the photos to them.
Oh my gosh.
It's just such a
How
wonderful thing.
amazing.
I mean, and she's a teacher, she's a school teacher, but she probably spends as much time doing this as she does teaching. And it's just phenomenal that she does this. So family may get photos of their great grandparents or great great grandparents
Wow.
that they had never seen before. In some cases, there's books and all kinds of different things. It's just really super. I have a photograph that my mother used to tell me was my paternal grandmother's brother. But the name on the back says Paolo Tornatone. And so he's not my grandmother's brother, that much I know. And I see that name in some of the as witnesses in some of the birth and death records, but I can't figure out who this guy is. He's in a military uniform, an officer's uniform, so he had stature. But I can't find this guy out. That's like my biggest roadblock now, is trying to figure out who this guy is.
I think we all get one of those, and my uncle and aunt or great uncle and auntie have this huge picture of this man. It's always hung in the entryway of their home, for as long as I can remember. It's enormous. It's like a poster size of this man, and he's standing up very straight, and he's posing, and he's in a suit. He looks to me like he's a groom. He's got the flower in his lapel, and I don't know why I've never asked who he was. Maybe because as a child, the picture perhaps, scared me a little bit, because he's staring at you and it's black and white. And I said to my auntie, I said, who is that man? And she said, oh, that was your great grandmother's, that was Nonna's brother. And I said, which brother? And she said, oh, he went to America, he played in a band or something, like he played the clarinet or something like that. And she said, and he went to Chicago, and one night he was hit by a train. And it was sort of this really tragic story always. And I thought, what was his name? Oh, his name was Pascal. I thought that's funny because that was my great grandfather's brother's name. And you sort of start to think, do they get, are they getting all the stories mixed up? Every couple of months, I would ask her again, who is that man again? What did you say about that man in the photo? Well, I think he's Nonna's brother. And I said, but where did the picture come from? Oh, your uncle got that printed in Palmy when we went there, and he bought it back. And on the back of it, it's printed here in Melbourne. And I said, well, it's framed here in Melbourne. She said, no, he got it framed there. And I thought, you're mixing. And even the photo, I ended up cutting the back because I couldn't help myself. I cut the back open. She doesn't know it's cut open. To try and see if there was anything on it. And I can see that it's old. It's older than 1968, which is when they went to Palmy. And I thought, no, this. And she said he bought it back from the house when we went there in 1968. And I said, this would have been an incredibly expensive photo to develop at the time. Its age suggests it was printed later. And I said, are you sure? Who do you think this is? She goes, no, his name's Vincenzo. And I thought, I knew that you didn't really know what his name was. Vincenzo, we've found it, but. And so I said to, that's the cousin in America that I said to her, I said, I actually think this is your great grandfather on his wedding day. And I said, I can't be sure. And I will keep finding as much information. And we've got an older picture of him. And I feel like it could be the same person, but there is nothing written on the back. There is no additional photos of him anywhere in the whole collection that I have. And I just said to her, I said, we have to find his marriage certificate. She said, I'm worried that it's in Italy. I'm worried he got married in Italy. I said, oh gosh, that will be an even bigger needle in the haystack if he got married there. the finding documents from Italy is just it's a real I found it a real challenge.
It is. You do get lucky, but it is tough. I never knew that my father had living first cousins in Torre del Greco until we got there last year.
Yeah.
Nobody ever talked, nobody ever mentioned it. And it was only my father's, I guess he's a half first cousin who's actually younger than me. That's a long story. My grandmother's youngest brother, his two daughters are still alive. They're both in their 90s. And when we got to their house, they had my parents' wedding photo that my grandmother had sent in 1944.
Oh my gosh.
And with my, obviously my grandmother's handwriting on the back. And I had no idea that these people existed.
Oh, wow.
And that's why I tell people, you can't just go to Rome and Florence,
No, that's right. That's right.
It's great, but that's not where you feel connected. You feel connected when you go to these smaller places, when you go to the hometown.
You absolutely do. And even the people I've met searching for information, the people that help me, that are the most unlikely people that you think would ever, particularly with the Italian side, there's so many people that are generations like my parents, who sort of say, no, these stories have to continue to be told. Or perhaps they have, other European, they're a descendant of someone else European and they see the value in it. But finding people to help you, with these little steps, with just little things to find different people. I've found it, I love how many people I've connected with. And thankfully I've got my mum's cousin, the eldest cousin. So he remembers quite fondly his grandparents. He said to me, what do you want to ask me? I said, right, I'm writing you a list of questions. You've got to fill the survey out. So he's in the midst of filling out all these questions. And I said, some of them are going to be really challenging. And he said, nope. He said, I'm ready for them. I'm ready for all of them. Because there's so many family tales that you hear about and different stories of things. And even as a child, things I was told about, my great-grandfather was apparently a very difficult man. That's how my great aunt, she says, he was impossible. He was impossible. And he fought with his sons a lot. But then, I also see things that he did. I mean, they would never know. I went to the Victorian archives and there was an application in the mid-50s that he'd written to the council and said, look, when there's a pine forest there that I know is going to be decommissioned, when it is, can you let me know? I want to buy this block here. And the reason I want to buy it is because I want my son to build a farm there. And that's something, he and his son fought. He did own a farm in there. They worked together. I've got log books that, for me, they're funny to read now. It's where they've written each other's wages and then another one of them's crossed it out and said, no, he didn't milk that many cows. He milked this many. And then someone else has crossed it out again. And I think, that's priceless to me. That's, you could never, ever replace that. But, he did really care. He did care about his kids and he did care about his grandchildren. He'd lived on a farm on his own for so long. He had absolutely no comprehension of how to show it. It wasn't even wanderlust he was looking for. He had a goal in mind and he achieved it. And, that I'm immensely proud of.
Yeah. Well, that's probably the most important thing, is to be able to do that. And, they were, things were different back then too. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. I'm so thrilled to have somebody Australian, I'll say it again, of Italian descent, because I've been on the search for so long. So, because it's a whole different perspective. And The fact that you found an American cousin is even
yes, better. Yes. No, absolutely. No, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.